This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for April 6th, 2021. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast, where we talk about everything by talking about video games. As always, I am Drew Messenger Michaels, and as always, I'm very glad you're here. Today I'm talking to Russell Quinn, whose work you might know if you remember the original McSweeney's app, which he built, or if you experienced the formerly experimental Noveloids, The Silent History, and The Pickle Index. We do discuss both of those works in this interview, and indeed we discuss how both are more recognizably game-adjacent in retrospect than they seemed to be at the time. But Russell is mostly here to talk about his new solo project, Linda and Joan, which, although it includes multiple semi-standalone releases, not to mention a series of zines, is nonetheless much more of a game than the aforementioned Noveloids. Given the subject matter of Linda and Joan, by the way, this episode does carry a content warning for death, illness, trauma, and everything that comes after those things. It gets pretty real, discretion advised, and all that. But it's a very good talk, and I think you're going to get a lot out of it, and Russell explains the particulars of the rest of it better than I would, so here we go.
It's bright out
yes, it
today,
is
but I'm
amazing.
Thinking
cool. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course.
Let's start in the simplest place. Let's start with the work and then go to the person. I think in this case, connecting the work to the person is probably not too difficult. For anybody who's not familiar, what is Linda and Joan?
So Linda and Joan is a narrative video game about a British family. It is based on a true story, specifically my family. and the main game primarily focuses on the final year in the lives of my mother and grandmother. They both died within a few weeks of each other in the winter of 2017. So the whole Linda and Joan project, it kind of encompasses three, maybe four different things. There's the main Linda and Joan game that I just described, which is currently in development and should be out in 2022. There is also a standalone prologue that is called 4 months Earlier, and that is set on a hiking trail in Los Angeles. And that is out now. It's about a 20-minute experience. It's a free download. And that kind of follows Russell and his mother, Linda, on a short hike in Los Angeles. In addition to those things, there is a very short vignette called The Candle, which is also a free download. Which is just basically a playthrough of a poem that Linda had written. And then the final component is the Zine Club, which is a very non-digital product, which is a series of 10 printed zines that you receive in the mail. And the zines kind of mix in elements of the real family behind the game, and also some in-game elements, and they just kind of build up the backstory of the characters. So yeah, so while the main game, the main Linda and Joan game, is the main thing, which is in development, and then there are these other three side projects.
So first of all, the work, or what I've seen of it so far, is beautiful. The prologue, thanks. I finished the prologue and I turned to my wife and I said, oh, this game is gonna fuck me up, were my exact words. It's beautiful in a really in a really profound way that I want to talk about. I think Franny may have mentioned in the pre-interview, my mom had cancer twice. I'm from Los Angeles, so that boy, that prologue did get to me
in
a bunch of ways. And the second time she had it, I was, you know, in my 20s and traveling a lot for work, so it's like I got to see her, but never for long. A lot of it resonated a whole lot. But I want to, you call these other elements side projects, and given some of your previous work and its focus on sort of spanning different media or different formats, do you consider sort of the main game the main thing, right? Is the Linda and Joan game the center, and do these other things orbit it? Or do you think of it, you know, and does that maybe differentiate this a little bit from some of the previous stuff you've worked on, which I do want to talk about? Or are they all parts of the same whole? Like would you need to take a look or at least be aware of all of them to get what you consider sort of the full picture or the full experience?
So definitely most of these things are standalone. I mean, that I think that you can just, like, you can do any one of them and you will get a complete story fragment which works in isolation. I refer to the Linda and Joan game that is in development as the main thing, because that will be the most substantial piece of work. The prologue, the candle, these things are all free downloads too. So the main game will be a paid for product, a much longer experience. But definitely, these things, you can kind of pick and choose. Like, you don't need to experience all these things for the main game to make sense. You can just play the main game when it comes out. But they all kind of interact too. Like, the prologue, as I'm sure we will get into, it kind of like paints a picture like before the events in the main game happened. It's called 4 months earlier because it's set 4 months before the timeline in the main game will begin. So you just build up more backstory. The Zine Club, while is like really the most standalone of these projects. It's a printed thing. It really focuses on my actual family that the game is based on. It's kind of a collection of artifacts and things from my family's history. But within these 10 zines, there will be these small clues and puzzles which you can use when you play the main game. And I will unlock optional side stories in the main game. So if you are a member of the Zine Club and you have gotten these 10 zines, then there will be some bonus content for you in the main game.
It harkens back to the era of, you know, hidden codes in manuals and things,
right?
A printed medium that reflects on or enhances the digital thing.
Exactly. If you play the main game and you have not read these zines, then those optional side scenes wouldn't even make a lot of sense to you probably, because they relate to backstory things from the zine. So so you can kind of you can take what you want. When the main game comes out, you can just download it from Steam and just play it. That can be your thing. If you want to dig deeper, then there are all these other options, these like tendrils of things that you can experience as well.
Tendrils is such a good word. It took you a while, I think, to find your way to making a game-ass game, for lack of a better term, which it seems Linda and Joan, and which the prologue, you know, is, at least in the modern indie sense, where I'm sure there are boring people out there who would quibble with whether it's a game or whatever, but that's less interesting than just the fact that it is recognizably in the tradition of other games. Whereas, again, I think some of your previous work, the Pickle Index and the Silent History, certainly, were more about being like traversing forms and maybe inventing a new form of form in some way. We can talk about those in more detail, but it's interesting that the tendrils all extend from something that is recognizably in, you know, a medium and to some degree a genre that people will recognize. Which is, I think, you know, it's not a good or a bad thing. It's just different from your approach in other projects. So I find it pretty interesting.
That was definitely a conscious decision. The definition of game is a fraught one, and yeah, like who really knows what it means? Everyone has a different interpretation. Yeah, I guess I mean technically, I mean this project is the first thing that I have built in a game engine. In Unity, it's the first thing that I've done in 3D. So by those definitions, yes, this is definitely the first game.
Sure. Which is a bit ironic, right? Because I was going to say your first job, correct me if I'm wrong, was at a games company, but you were making the kinds of things that people do not generally make from scratch, at least as a matter of course anymore. You're making compilers and things. Now that you've come around to making a game, oh, excuse me, got some barking dogs. Give me just a moment. I will let me put them in dog jail very briefly. I'm very sorry. I'll be right back.
No, it's fine.
Let the record show that dog jail is simply another equally comfortable room of the house where dog barking can be heard less readily by the podcast microphone. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast neither practices nor endorses retributive dog justice. Sorry about that.
Hey.
Big day on the block. Neighbors are getting deliveries. This is unacceptable. Oh, wow. I must be defended from the UPS guy, certainly. I admire the hustle.
Yeah, no,
okay.
It's fine.
Okay, good. But yeah, and I was just saying, you know, you started out making compilers and things, and you've come back around to making games, and you're not really focused on that kind of low level programming that I think has, you know, was your bread and butter for a while. I think is one of the things you've shown yourself to be very good at. You're using Unity. You're using something that is a more of an off the shelf tool. It's sort of the story of game development over the last couple of decades, in a certain sense.
Right. Yeah, that full circle is interesting. Yeah, so I studied computer science at Cardiff University in the UK, where I'm from. And yeah, my first job out of university was working for a fairly small company that made most of the tools that games developers used to make the games.
The company didn't make the games themselves. You made middleware would probably be
exactly
the wrong word, you made tools. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the tool chain. So, it was like the compiler, the assembler, the linker, things that actually turn the code into, the executable. We also branched out and made, performance analyzers, software that you can see how well your game is running. And debuggers and like all these other things. Yes, and I worked there for 5 years. And that company was acquired by Sony in the final year. And like at the time, we were making tools for Nintendo and for Sony, for like all of the consoles. And then that company was acquired by Sony, and they still exist now as like a 100% Sony owned company, and they just make tools for the PlayStation. So I was really working on very low level things. Game development back then was very different from what it has evolved and has evolved into. It was much harder for independent developers to even get access to the development hardware for these consoles, have the resources and the software to make games in a faster way. I was there for 5 years, and now all these years later, I got back into the games industry from a different angle, like this time from a developer, and I'm using the tools instead of making them, and those tools have evolved so much further that. Yeah, because we all know there is this very rich ecosystem of development tools that now make it possible for small teams. In my case, I'm a team of one person to make.
It can get any smaller, yeah.
Right.
No, that's interesting because, I mean, the other thing that makes this different is a lot of what you did in between those two jobs had to do with creating the framework. And I don't want to in any way imply that this is not creative work, right? But your focus was not so much the narrative itself as enabling the narrative in a lot of cases. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong there, but my understanding is certainly when you worked on the McSweeney's app, which was way ahead of its time in terms of a subscription multimedia service, or your work on the Silent History and the Pickle Index, which maybe this is a good time to talk a bit more about what those actually were. You've said it a bunch of places, so let me say it briefly so you don't have to repeat yourself. But the Silent History was basically, let me describe it and you tell me if I'm describing it wrong. It was, in my memory and in my experience as someone who read it, it was a novel that tried to present itself in a way you could only present a novel on a smart device, a tablet or a phone. You got it episodically, and you also got little side stories, location specific, right? And so first of all, is that right? And am I right that your role was more making that work than working on what the story is, whereas with Linda and Joan, it's very much your story?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, so that's, The Silent History came out in 2012, and it was myself and three writers. And so, yes, I definitely, those three writers were like writing the text, and I was designing and programming the app. But also we like very consciously built those things side by side. So especially back then, in the early 2010s, there was a lot of like experiments in like interactive narratives where it felt like story and technology were very disjoint. There were examples of like writers just going off and like writing a story that they thought was interactive, and then like finding a development team afterwards and being like, yeah, like here's my. My great story. Now, like, go ahead and make it into a thing. And like, often it didn't work. Or examples of like tech companies making a platform and then like trying to encourage writers to like jump in and make their interactive thing. The approach that we took was like consciously we were like always talking, and these two things were built up side by side. So they were very like informing each other. Even though the actual work that was being done, the writing and the programming was like the jobs of distinct people. And like everybody was involved in like a lot of the choices about the features and the story, how the story and it played back into what the app could do.
Yeah. I think you're totally right that what a lot of those other solutions or attempts at, figuring out what a digital story looks like lacked was what we'd now call, a discipline that existed certainly in the early 2010s, but that we didn't maybe talk about as much outside of the production pipeline, which is narrative design, right? There was a story and there was technology, but the two were not necessarily speaking to each other in a particularly interesting way. Whereas I think the Silent History, I think it shows that the two things were built as one or very, very closely related to one another.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. So the Silent History, as you were saying, I was told in two parts. The core part of the story was this like serialization where every Monday through Friday, then you got a new chunk of the story, which sounds like pretty ordinary now, but was kind of revolutionary back then. And then the second part were these like tangential short stories that were actually placed on a map, and you actually had to go to that physical location to read them. And they involved things that you could see in the real world. So there might be a story about that was set in like a side alley with like a chain link fence, and somebody shouting from a window, and like a fight broke out, and they rolled into a red door and like dented it. And like from that location, you were stood in that side alley and you could see that fence and that window, and there was a red door that had a dent in it. So writers would go out and they write these things. So it was like recontextualizing the real world. Maybe like a early Pokemon Go in a way.
We would very comfortably call that AR today, right? Like it's
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. It was very ahead of its time in that sense. But I love that approach where, like, what's really hard about AR is, of course, like, you can't reach out and touch things. So the approach that the story took place here, but you're not seeing the story happen, you're seeing the traces of the story. It's incredibly clever. So that's the silent history, and I think there were, I remember there being a lot of think pieces at the time about how this was the future of novels.
Yes.
And
there was. The thought, kind of strange to us, and kind of informs the Pickle Index, which was the next project that came out in 2015. Which was almost like a direct reaction to all of those think pieces saying that, this is the future of the book. Because to us, the silent history did not feel like the future. It was just like one thing that we made. And we put like a lot of thought into like that project, but we're not thinking about, that this should be the only way that people should read. I mean, that felt kind of ridiculous to us. So. The Silent History was an app. A printed book did come out later, because the story was like acquired by a publisher, and then we made like a printed version of the story. But the print format of the Silent History was never the intention. Like, the app just existed, and the printed book that came out in bookstores was an afterthought. So for the Pickle Index, we set out to make an app and a book, a printed book, that were equivalent. And they were both like the primary product. And you could experience the story in either format. So instead of the future of the book, the Pickle Index had like a number of different futures of the book.
Sure,
Like tongue-in-cheek, that the reader could choose from.
Very tongue-in-cheek about the idea of multiplicity, right? Because even the printed edition, if I have my facts straight, was two editions. It was two books that you had to sort of ping-pong back and forth between, or even like tessellate the two versions of to get the full picture. So it was even itself, not just two possible futures, but two simultaneous presents of not just the book, but the book you were currently reading.
Exactly. Yeah. And the like the story of the Silent History was much more like serious in tone. It told the story of a generation of children that were born without the sense of language, and it kind of follows them over a few decades as they grow up. So it starts from like their parents' point of view, as they're like concerned about this new thing that is happening more and more in newborn babies. And then like follows these kids as they grow up and how like different parts of society react to them. The Pickle Index was more of a goofy story. This was set in a slightly wacky totalitarian state where they had a shortage of food, but they did have a surplus of pickles and other fermented goods. And so the fictional government in the story makes an app. Like a recipe sharing app, which every citizen is required to upload a new pickle related recipe every day, and share it with like their network. It's kind of like a propaganda tool to encourage the citizens of this fictional country to eat the food that they did have and not long for better foods.
It's a beautiful piece of satire, by the way, because I mean, how are we supposed to be using apps and social media if not for basically that, right? To insist that everything is fine, even though we're all perfectly aware it isn't.
Exactly. So like the app, was the Pickle Index app itself. So like immediately, you launch it, and it's supposed to be, this app that like a weird like government department put together as like a propaganda recipe sharing app, and so it has a news channel where every day you get new news updates from the government, and then there is this like recipe sharing side where all of these citizens are like sharing their own recipes, and so as soon as you launch it, then you are a citizen in the fictional world. You are using this app. And the story takes place over 10 days in real time. And each day you get a new news update from the government. And then you get to explore the shared recipes that are being shared. Most of them are just weird recipes with old fermented meats and like weird things.
Sure.
But then within this world, I'm a young girl, by the name of Flora, figures out that while everybody is uploading their daily mandated recipes, nobody is really reading them or checking them. So she starts using this as like a journaling platform, like a blogging platform, and starts like sharing her side of the events. So you get these parallel stories of like the official government view through the news channel, and then like Fiora on like Flora's take on it through and like her uploading her like journal entries to like the recipe sharing network. So like you're bouncing around like discovering the story over 10 days, and then this like wild caper unfolds. So that's the app. Then we also released this hardcover book, which as you mentioned, I was actually two books inside of a slipcase. And the first book was the government side of the story, and the second book was Flora's side. And so you bounce back and forth over the 10 days. I'm like in the app, the 10 days unfold in real time. I'm like in the book, you just go back and forth. So you read day one in book one, then day one in book two, then day two in book one, and so forth. And then finally, I'm like in these books, then every day in the two books, I have these like full spread illustrations that like tessellate. You like join up the books and you see like this whole image. And again, I'm at the government side of the image, like a rosy, nice looking world. And Flora, the citizen's view of the world, is more like grimy and realistic. And yeah, like you didn't have to read both for the story to make sense. I'm like, you could do the inside out version, which was like being a citizen in the fictional world and actually using the Pickle Index, the app. Or you could do the outside in version, which was reading the book of the story, which was how we all read books normally. Yeah, so many, many features of storytelling.
The outside in versus inside out thing is perhaps the way in which the Pickle Index is the most game-like as compared to the Silent History. We could now think of, if we recognize the site-specific stuff in the Silent History as AR, then that's game adjacent in a way that is more obvious now than it was then. But the idea of the app being in-world, right, like it is a more game-like way of relating to a story, generally speaking, that you're supposed to be in it as opposed to reading it. And I think that's where the Pickle Index sort of declares itself not just a content delivery system for an existing format like the novel or the short story, but an experiment in what all this stuff is even.
Yes, exactly. And as like a user of the Silent History app, like essentially you were still on a reader. But in the Pickle Index, you were a citizen in the world and you were a player. And like you were taking part in like in this and like you had a part to play in this world in real time.
Which is a promise games make and keep to varying degrees, I think. But yeah.
So like the ways that the Pickle Index was not a game was still like ultimately it was still like a novel length worth of text, and there were large blocks of text that you read, and more like technically like it was not built in a game engine. It was a native app for the iPhone and the iPad. Yeah, so
You built
while
that for the from the ground up, if I'm not mistaken, yeah.
Correct. Yeah, so you're right that these things were kind of moving more and more away from from novels through like interactive novels through like I'm like giving the reader a role in the game world to this project, which is and is built in a game engine and is also a game, some might say.
And there was, I believe, one intermediate step that I've heard you talk about a bit less in between the Pickle Index and starting or at least starting in earnest on Linda and Joan. You did work with gallery art stuff. Is that right?
And I did some this installation for Miranda July, which was in the V&A Museum, the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. And that was a project where we had these four very grand curtains that were in the museum. And they opened and closed using some home automation technology based on the actions of an Uber driver who was based in Los Angeles, who had insomnia. And so we were we were tracking various activities of his using off-the-shelf gizmos, sleep trackers and things. And then they're linking this up in real time to these curtains that were based in London, and then opening and closing them to simulate what he was doing. So it was part of a larger exhibition on the future of technology that the museum was doing. And they wanted this art installation that had a different take on it. So while I've been doing all these projects for myself or with my collaborators, then I also do freelance work with artists and other writers who need technology in some format.
Yeah, that really has been the theme, I suppose, right? The enabling technology and expressing things through that. I mean, the Miranda July piece is such a great example of how the connection between the real-time data, I suppose, and the more, recognizable physical, gallery object, like the connection between the two things is the point, right? Neither by itself really is the work. So it's
right.
But again, you're enabling, a vision that you're not in complete control of. Whereas now, I assume it would be a stupid question to ask why you felt the need to sort of take on the solo project. It seems like you went through something really harrowing and difficult and felt the need to express it. And I believe you've said elsewhere, to go through something traumatic and express it in art is an extremely normal thing in basically any medium. But there's still this slight knee-jerk reaction for some people when it's a game that it's like, I mean, okay, yeah, universally recognizable human emotion, but what's the core loop? I think the other thing you've said is here there is a core loop, right? Taking care of someone is deeply sad, but also like a Tamagotchi, I think is the way you put it. There are these minute tasks that are game-like in a way that's sort of brutal but recognizable.
So I had finished the Pickle Index, and then I had been doing some freelance work with other artists for a few years. I had been living up in the Bay Area, a couple of hours north of San Francisco. And then I moved down to Los Angeles in 2016. And then I wanted to make a game, which at that point I primarily meant working in a game engine. I had become a little frustrated with, it was so hard to put these interactive novel projects into a category because they were so oddly shaped and strange. They were unique and didn't really have a built-in audience. And we spent a lot of time trying to attract people from the world of literature who were interested in interactive projects. And I really wanted to do a narrative project that maybe appealed to people from the gaming community. So coming at it from a different approach. And I was just getting tired of making native apps for the iPhone, and I wanted to work in a game engine. So at the beginning of 2017, then I was just prototyping a bunch of ideas, and I was just working by myself at this point. I had this game about a mountain goat who lived at the top of a very snowy mountain with its owner, the farmer. The farmer dies, and then the mountain goat is left alone to fend for itself, and has to kind of find its way down the mountain, it meets all these other animals along the way. And then you kind of control this pack or this herd of like different assorted animals, and you use their varying skills as a group to then yeah, like fend for yourself in the world. And I was getting kind of deep into that when, yeah, like all these events started unfolding in my own family, where in the summer of 2017, then my mother's breast cancer had come back. She had had breast cancer before in 1997, had like been given the all clear for years, and then it had come back and was stage four. And had been like kept at bay for like a short time, and then I like, suddenly became extremely aggressive. And so I decided to go back and be with my mother. Like initially she was going to have like 6 weeks of chemotherapy to try and like knock it back. And like, there was no cure, but it would, but I hopefully would like shrink it, and she could go on for, I don't know, for some more years.
Sure.
So I like, dropped working on this like prototype of this mountain goat game, and then headed back to my like smallest hometown in England. I'm like an only child. My dad died very suddenly from leukemia like 3 months before I was born, when my mother was 24. And so she raised me by herself. I don't have any siblings. Like my other grandparents had died. I just had my mother and my grandmother, my maternal grandmother. And so, yeah, like I dropped everything. I went back for the 6 weeks. I like looked after my mother while she was going through this chemotherapy, and then it became very clear that it wasn't working, and she started to get more and more sick. And then I ended up staying for longer and longer, and was her full-time caregiver like for months. Like back in my like childhood house in my like hometown, where I hadn't lived then for like 20 years, and didn't really know many people beyond my mother's neighbors and a couple of school friends that still lived in town. So there were all these feelings of like suddenly being dragged back to my past and like confronting like my own childhood. I'm also being a full-time caregiver. My wife stayed in Los Angeles and had to carry on working and running our lives here. So it was a very like a lonely, I'm a lonely and scary time. My mother eventually died like in the December of 2017. I came back to Los Angeles after the funeral for like a couple of weeks, and I just to take a break before I went back to like clear her house and sell it. And then I got news that my grandmother had fallen in her house. I mean, she lived in like the next town over, and she had fallen and broken her hip, and then died during surgery. And she I was 89, and she was like my other living like immediate family member. So like suddenly I had lost like my two last family members. They both like still lived in the houses that they and I had lived in for my whole life. So like these two buildings that were my like anchors to my home country. And then like really like the reason for going back to the UK had gone. I'm like I left the UK in 2005. And I really, like my main connection was going back like every year or two to visit them. So suddenly, yeah, like all these feelings of like losing my family, losing my connection to my homeland. I was turning 40 that year, so all these, yeah, like an identity crisis kind of I like spilled out of that. And by the time I got like back to Los Angeles in like end of March in 2018. Then I had like all of these feelings to unpack. And then the first day back at my desk, I like brought up like the mountain goat game again, and I didn't have the same like feelings
Sure.
for working on that prototype anymore. And yeah, like I went to therapy for a while, was like trying to get my life back on track and figuring things out. And then I was spending much of time just like reading up about like how other people I dealt with like trauma like this. I was experiencing like PTSD and a lot of like flashbacks and nightmares. Like a lot of it from like the massive disconnect between. Like all these things happened in like a country far away. Like in like a cold, rainy, English winter, and then suddenly I was back in like sunny Los Angeles, and like none of my friends here had like experienced what I had done there. Like the people that I had shared that trauma with back, like in the UK, were not here, and so I felt very, like alone with my story. I didn't have like other family members to even like grieve with in the same way. And then I started reading about how other people that like told stories or like made things and like how they dealt with trauma. And as you alluded to, I suddenly realized how like common it is. And like even if it's not a retelling of the direct story, obviously novelists write things about their experiences, and like filmmakers build those things into their movies. And like I'm not those things. I'm like a technologist, I guess, who like. And it has worked in storytelling. And I suddenly, it just felt, it's so obvious to me in like that period of grief that I needed to like share my story through this medium that I knew. And I felt kind of like empowering that, that I could do everything by myself, right? Even if, I'm not like the greatest 3D modeler in the world, I'm not the greatest. I'm like other things, but I could like technically do it to some level. So that feeling of power was strong, and it felt like this option to like share this story that was just, inside me now. Like all of the memories of my family were just mine. I didn't have anyone to share it with. So kind of building this out and like into a thing that I could share with other people and feel less lonely in my own experiences, as well as hopefully giving people a way that they could either find comfort by like playing through a thing that they had had personally experienced some aspect of, or a way of playing through some experiences that they would experience in the future. Because even though these themes are like very unique to my family, they're also like broken down piece by piece. They're like universal themes that everybody will experience from some point of view, right? So it just all seemed to come together that this was the thing that I wanted to work on, and for like a while, it felt like the only thing that I could work on, like emotionally, and it felt like, it was comforting to like spend time in that world. And to have almost like the privilege of like giving myself the time to work through the trauma from that year.
I mean, thank you for walking through all that. And I guess the first question that springs to mind among many is, did it continue to feel therapeutic? Because, I mean, famously, when you take on a solo project, you have the benefit, of course, of being experienced and I'm sure scoping it in a realistic way, more or less from the beginning and all of that. But have there been times when it's been, has it mostly been good to work through this using this project, or have there been times when it's almost, tough to sit with it, as sort of your job?
Yeah. I would say that it's almost universally been good. And there are definitely times when, the reality of what I'm doing and doubts kind of creep in. Like everything from like, wait, am I crazy for doing this? Or am I so like deeply traumatized by that experience that like what I'm doing is not like rational? Like the day before I released the prologue, which is like essentially walking my mother and me up this hiking trail. Suddenly the realization that I was giving strangers the agency to like play as my mother was scary. So there are definitely these days when things feel, like risky, and I like second guess myself. But on the whole, it's just, I think it feels like therapy every day in a productive way. And I can definitely chart, me coming to terms with what happened directly with the experience of making this game. And I've never been the type of person who just tries to ignore what happens. So I confront big issues in my life among the world by leaning into them and like trying to to think about them from every different angle. But actually having that time. I mean, not just going back to work or taking a job and getting back to normal life in a way that I didn't have time to process this. I think for me, that would have been a bad decision. So the fact that I can sit here, 9 to 5, and then I think about things in the way that I have to make sense of them, right? Because the process, I started this with a jumble of thoughts and memories and emotions. But to tell a cohesive story, you have to turn that into a story. And that takes a process. It has to be understandable to other people. You have to figure out what is the most important part of it. And then that's also is that kind of how my mind works. I need to rationalize things to a point that they sit in a comfortable way for me. So having to do that with my real life has proven to be a useful form of therapy for myself.
That's amazing. I'm glad to hear that. And if you ever feel crazy, hopefully one of the things that makes you feel less crazy is that, I'm sure I'm not the first person to tell you that it's a pretty beautiful piece of work, as I think I've already said. And it feels very real and very true. And even just the prologue works through some incredibly specific emotions that I think not that many works take on. There's that thing. I think it captures this very specific thing where when there's a credible threat, like cancer on the table, and you're legitimately not sure how much time you have left with someone, there's this constant push and pull between how much do I want to get into the real stuff, which is my person, by disposition, that's what I always want to do as well, and not leave things unsaid, versus how much do I want to just enjoy the time we have, whatever we've got. And it's obviously you want both, but those two goals can be at odds. And that's sort of what the prologue in particular, at least on my reading, is about, right? It's how much do we want to get into this? How much do we try to ignore it? How much do we pretend things are normal? And it's just very delicate and raw and human. And I guess there's a question in there somewhere, but mostly just thank you for sharing it.
Thanks. I mean, that was definitely the aim of the prologue was, in real life, my mother had come out to visit me here in Los Angeles for 2 weeks. And she was a very, a nervous traveler, and I didn't really like flying or traveling much. So for her to make it out was a big deal in itself. That period was right on the cusp. We knew that her cancer had come back, but she was undergoing some minor treatment programs that were keeping it at bay. And she was mostly living a normal life. Within weeks after she got back, then things to escalate. So as you were saying, that walk and the conversations that we were having, it really captured this moment when serious things were brewing, were happening, but they also weren't an immediate problem. Any parent-child situation, you fall back into old routines and tendencies, right? You both love spending time together, especially when you live thousands of miles apart. But also, it's kind of boring and frustrating, and you both like kind of irritate each other, and like you also love each other, and you also like want to talk about serious things, and like you're also both walking on like up a hill on like a hot day, and so I didn't want to make it like overly like sentimental or like overly romanticize this time. Like in the prologue, I mostly wanted to capture that like feeling of like a relationship with like a, like an adult child and like a parent, where there's all these like mix of like a boredom, routine, annoyance, love, and like compassion. Like you love being together, but also it's hard, right? And it can be hard hanging out alone with your parents, and hard for the parent too. All like with this this undercurrent of like foreshadowing on like of what is going to happen next, which like hopefully gives like the banality of a lot of the conversation of the small talk that is happening this like this like deeper meaning that in real life we didn't have at the time because we didn't know like how near it was to all taking a turn.
It's an incredible storytelling gesture to make this the prologue, because it's exactly the kind of conversation, exactly the kind of experience that means more in retrospect, perhaps, than it even did at the time. That, you know, the kind of thing where you go over it a million times in your head because it's shortly before everything started to get serious, but it can only be that once things got serious. You couldn't have possibly known that at the time.
Right. Yeah. Like in the, like the other choice for making the prologue, I guess I came from my like self-doubt in that it seemed like such a risk to work for like 2 or 3 years on the main game. And for like that entire time, have this like underlying worry about things, like letting players control me and my mother, or like how people would react to this. I decided to like stop working on the main game and spend a few months in making this prologue as a way of releasing a thing into the real world and like gauging the reaction. Mm-hmm. So like giving myself the confidence that that there were people that would connect to the story and that it wouldn't all go horribly wrong and be received in a terrible way.
Sure.
Technically, as I've said a few times, I never made a game in a game engine. I had never like released a game on Steam before. So just going through that like technical workflow on a smaller project meant that now I've gone through like every one of these workflows. I've made a game, I've finished, and I just like other small game, this prologue, I've released it on itch, on Steam, on the Mac App Store, on the iOS App Store. And so I've gone through that process. It's been released. There was nobody had negative feedback on the story and what happened. Nobody made me feel bad about that. Overwhelmingly, the people who just send me emails and contact me out of the blue have these beautiful stories about what it meant to them. So I can now spend the next 12 to 18 months that it's going to take to finish the main Linda and Joan game, at least feeling a little bit more like confident that it's not all going to go terribly wrong when I release it.
Because
I can physically release a game, and the response to this was I was good. I think that these things are so important, and especially when you're just a single person team and you don't have the daily echo chamber of like your teammates all believing in each other and like supporting the idea, that I think it's important to like reach out to the world, or like a subset of the world, and can give yourself like a little bit of a bump that that what you're working on every day has some to it. yeah, so those were kind of all of the reasons why, like, why I stopped working on the main game, and then I made and released this prologue.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's also, I mean, it's an incredible test run, I suppose. We haven't actually said, it serves as an incredible test run for the, you know, the empathy and the, like you said, having people play as you and your mother, which, you know, I notice you sort of drift between that and calling the characters, you know, Russell and Linda, which I totally get, right? They're, you know, Russell is you, Russell in the game is you, but not you. It, you know, you always pick both characters' dialogue options, but you have the choice up front in the options menu as to whether you're just controlling Russell's pace of walking and doing your best to match sort of a set pace for Linda, or whether you're controlling both of them. And that itself is really interesting. And I'm curious if you took any specific sort of lessons about how much how much control you should give the player over each character from that. But it seemed a very fascinating design choice to me. And I think the game refers to the mode where you control both of them as challenging mode. It is a lot harder. But the game, no matter what, captures that sense of split attention of, like, trying to care for someone's physical needs. And in this case, a very simple and straightforward way, while trying to carry on a conversation. So was that sort of part of it too, trying to figure out to what degree players could handle that sort of split attention?
Yeah. And it was a bit, the central game mechanic in the prologue is also kind of entirely different from what it will be in the main game. in the prologue, as you said, you're walking these two characters up this hiking trail. And the Russell character, who is younger and more healthy, has a faster walking speed than Linda, who is walking with a stick. She has, like, slight knee pain, and so she's walking with a stick. So it's kind of playing on this friction of, it's frustrating to have to slow down, and it's frustrating to have to keep up. So you have to balance these two walking speeds. And in the default mode, you just control the walking speed of Russell, and then Linda follows. But you kind of have to match her speed. And she will get slower and slower as she walks up the hill, because as in real life, the further you walk, the slower you get. There are things, there's like a bench halfway up where you can stop and sit. I'm gonna sit down, the delay reboosts the character's energy levels. There are, like, certain things in the conversation that can make the characters feel happier or sadder, and that, like, morale boost can, like, I can give them a physical boost. And so you're always you have to walk and talk at the same time. So you're kind of like advancing the conversation between the two characters. And then every now and again, you have to reset the walking speed and try and keep them so they are walking within earshot. If they start walking too far apart, then the speech in the text bubbles on screen, it kind of gets all, like, blurry or jittery, and you can't really hear what they are saying. You can just... if you just want to finish the game, then you can just, then Russell can, like, march up the hill by himself, and Linda can walk by herself. That's like a perfectly valid way to play it. How that makes you feel is like a thing to explore, maybe. In that case, you won't have a conversation because they cannot hear each other. So that friction of parent child, having different physical needs on this walk, and having to find this common ground in walking speed, as well as common ground in the conversation, was like the whole point of the game mechanic in the prologue. The main Linda and Joan game is much more of a narrative adventure game where you actually control all three characters. So You control Russell, the son, Linda, the mother, and then Joan, the grandmother. And you can switch back and forth in between them. And it's more of a point and click experience when, like, you're walking around this, you're like, these are these small houses in England and interacting with things. And this time as the player, you are playing the role of the family unit. So you can switch back and forth between the three characters, but you really are the family. And so like the central premise of the main game is that you cannot change the story. The story is kind of on rails. Like the events that happen will happen. There are not multiple endings where you can change who dies or what happens in the game. Like the story marches on, no matter what you do, but you have a lot of control over how the people are feeling. So by the different actions that you take, you can make these three characters make the most of the time that they have left, or helping each other to get through this time, which mirrors real life for me. I'm in a big way where as soon as my mother got her terminal diagnosis, which was a few months before she died, then life feels like it's on rails. Like you know that that saving a miracle, the miss is at the end of the story and has been written. And like you can't change it. Yet you have to go on living in that time. And as a family unit, like you want to help each other. Like everybody is like worried about each other for different reasons. And so most decisions are on like caregiving and but also spending time with like nice memories and trying to do nice things. So in the game, you're controlling how the characters feel and how you choose to spend that time. And it's really playing up the power of the family unit of those three members of those three generations in this family to get through that very difficult time. Until, of course, ultimately there's only one character left, Russell, who is based on me, who then like lives with his memories and his experience into the future.
Yeah, that aspect of playing as the entire family unit in sort of the last period during which the three people comprise a family unit is really intense and beautiful. And I think that's an interesting thing to think about, where the ending is fixed, but it's all in how you get there. Because that's an idea that I think exists in a whole lot of narrative games. That some of the choices you're making are not so much about a branching narrative, but they're expressive choices, right? Like what's going to happen is going to happen. Nothing changes, right? But there is a point to which you're going. I think that's that structure for a game is an extremely good metaphor, as you said, for points in life where it's clear what's going to happen, but it's not clear what's going to happen between now and then. That's sort of that bizarre, liminal, like emotionally fraught space.
Yeah. Yeah, like, and also, yeah, like the realization that, like, as soon as you realize that you can't really control what is going to happen, but you can control, like, your interpretation of it
sure.
and your own mind.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, you still have control over how you process things, how you think about things. And so I think in real life, yeah, like, all of one's attention then it changes to that. And so like in the game, like you will have like feedback what these three characters, what like memories they're building, what like memories they are thinking about, how they are feeling. So you will be able to like change the outcomes of like the contents of their mind. they're like inner lives.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is all we as humans. It's all the control that we as humans have at times. when like things in the real world become uncontrollable. So yeah, so there's a lot of like storytelling and choices and impact to be had over the inner lives of these characters, even though the actual world events are going to happen no matter what.
That's, I think, an under-discussed potential of games and game-like objects. I would just broadly say games. Be kind of loose with the definition. But the idea that, like, I think too often games are spoken of as though they are spaces of infinite choice, or that's what they ought to be. And anything where you're circumscribing the player's choice is a flaw in the medium that eventually will work out, and you'll have a perfect game where you can do whatever you want. Games are sort of interesting precisely because they're not that, right? That the choices themselves are laid out intentionally, and that there are aspects that the player, at least in the moment, you know, without mods or whatever, cannot change. It seems to me again that this is the kind of story that gets told a bit less, but is like perfect for the medium in a way that is easy not to remark upon, right? Like it's obvious when you see it, but and I don't get the sense that you have too much hesitation about this being a game anymore at this point, but it, you know, I think that's why some people might think that they don't want to play a game about this particular thing as a knee-jerk reaction. But I think it's also why the experience can be so, so powerful.
Yeah, I think so. Like the branching narrative thing is interesting. Like, and while there are like many good examples these days, like for me, when I play like a very story-driven action game, like somewhere in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking like which one is the one that like the writer and other writers really want me to experience?
Yeah.
Version
What's
the is
the canon
best one?
Ending? Sure.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like you read a novel, and like while it was being written, you know, there were like hundreds of versions maybe, and then they were like edited down into one singular vision that the author and their editor decided on, right? So I think that's probably why, in even though the Silent History and the Pickle Index were interactive and had like optional parts in a way, they were never like branching dialogues. And because to me, like the branching that happens is happening in the reader's mind, like how every reader comes away from experiencing a mostly linear story like that, with their own like set of emotions, their own feelings, their own interpretation of what happened, which is based on like how they read it, where they read it, their own like lived experience up until this point. So everyone has like a very different experience, even though the story is maybe linear. So for Linda and Joan, I wanted there to be this this kind of like linear story, but it gives the player like a way of exploring and even like documenting how they feel while they are playing it. So it's not like entirely happening in their own heads. There's also there's ways that I can feed back into the actual game.
Yeah, I mean, all art, I suppose, exists between the artist and the person, viewing, listening to, playing it, whatever they're doing. Right. Like I can't access the thing itself any more than you have control over my interpretation of the thing itself. Right. There's the thing itself, but that's not only what you put in or only what I get out. And it seems to me that the tone here definitely embraces that this is going to be, this is a personal experience for the person who made it. It's also going to be a personal experience inevitably for the people playing it. And I think it leaves room for, you know, for that thing to happen that is so contradictory but so beautiful, where something quite specific and personal becomes universal exactly because it's so specific and so personal.
Yeah. I mean, that like timeline of how that like power dynamic changes is so interesting. This project, I mean, the first like 2 months of this project, I was like 3D modeling on like my mother's living room and like finding comfort in like being able to be in a version of that space again. That house was like sold and remodeled and like changed. So my like family home no longer exists in that same state. So like that experience is just like, is like 100% personal and like therapeutic. Like only means a thing to me really. For like the period that I am making it. Yet, like at some point this game, and it will come out, will be released. And then even further into the future, when like I've moved on from this game, then hopefully people are like still finding it and downloading it and playing it and having their own experience. I'm probably not even thinking about it on every day, right? So like, yeah, so that like timeline of like the maker's interpretation and what the process of making it meant to them versus what story like a player or a reader gets from a work at like some point in the future when they're like overlaying their own experiences onto that are like so far apart, and there's like no way for those two people to have the same experience. But hopefully they make this like intense connection somehow through like the wormhole of time between those two extremes, which is, it's hopefully the point of art that works, I guess.
Yeah, no, it is like a wormhole, because you are right back there in some sense, but it's also like, I think the way you describe the sort of diffusion of who gets to own the meaning or experience it is so beautiful, because it starts out being very much, as a solo developer, it starts out being completely in your head, and then you show it to a few people, and then a few more people play it, and then a few more people play it, and as you say, you've moved on, but it keeps going outward, and individual people find it hopefully when they need it, or there are like book clubs or whatever, but groups of people find it, someone shows it to someone saying, hey, this really helped me, it might help you, and by that point it's it's still a thing you made. It has your stamp on it, of course, but it's out of your hands. And that's beautiful too.
Yeah. Yeah. It has served its purpose for me at some point in the future, but then, it's then owned by other people who hopefully find new purpose. Yeah. But that's still some way away. I still have like a year.
That's fair.
Like
that's
a year
fair.
Or more to finish the game. but it's nice,
it's beautiful. I can't wait to play the whole thing, and I expect it to wreck me, as I said. My mom recovered, to be totally clear, but I remember the fear.
I'm
and
glad to
you
hear.
Know oh thank you yeah. thank you yeah she's been cancer free for 5-6 years now. Mm-hmm. But I mean she went through it when I was in high That's school great. And then she went through it again when I was an adult, and I was taking care of her a fair bit when I was in high school, but I didn't know what the hell I was doing. That whole feeling your way thing is definitely like, I can understand that, but like you said, these are experiences everyone experiences in some form, going back to a place where you're no longer quite a local, remembering right. connections, losing people. This is universal human stuff, even though it doesn't look quite the same for any two people.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for sharing it. I mean, I know it's been helpful for you, but I can tell you already it's extremely helpful for me as well. It's already helped me work through some stuff.
That's very good to hear.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being generous with your time and being emotionally and intellectually generous. Like the work itself is that, but also like, thank you for being willing to talk about the real stuff. It means a lot.
Yeah. No problem at all. Thank you for listening and for having me on.
Of course. Take care. Best of luck finishing the project, and have a really good one.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, take care soon. And thank you. Bye.
Bye. And that's the show. You can wishlist the main Linda and Joan game on Steam. You can find all things Linda and Joan, including that, the Zine Club, the standalone episode The Candle, and the 4 months earlier prologue at lindajoan.com. Links to that, as well as to the Silent History, the Pickle Index, and Russell's social media mabobs in the show notes. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, with support, just plain support, to be honest, in good times and bad, from Francis Michelle Cannon and Lucio Valentino. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker, using icons from The Noun Project. You can find the show everywhere podcasts are a thing, including but by no means limited to wherever you're listening to it right now. If you'd like to support the show, and if you are able to do so without causing yourself any hardship, you are very welcome to do so by buying something on our Nexus page at nexus.gg/ETAO. That's nexus.gg/ETAO. Or by patronizing us at patreon.com/ETAO. I think you know how to spell Patreon, but patreon.com/ETAO. Thanks tremendously to our current patrons, with an extra tremendous thanks to the mysterious Ian K, Lucas Cosen, and Darth Raptora. For those of you who enjoy our streams, which we do on YouTube, Twitch, and Periscope, I am well aware that the schedule has been even more sparse than usual lately, but I assure you there will be more streams. More N64 games, more of me and Adam playing Crusader Kings 3, more of me and Lucio playing something. We haven't really decided yet. I do want to say, however, that the reason the streams have been a bit more sparse is because I've been working on some other bigger side projects, which I am very excited to announce to you, and should be ready to announce to you, in 2 weeks' time, on the next episode of this here podcast. So that is one reason among many that I hope to see you then. Until then, take care, everybody.